This is going to be the last morning talk by me. because tomorrow you have Ajahn Brahmali. First of all, there's no preferences, being content and easily satisfied. But anyway, because that is this evening after the Sutta class, I'm going off to Dhammaloka to do my services there. And tomorrow morning, I think Ajahn Brahmali will be here for next morning's talk at 8 o'clock to 9, followed by metta meditation for those coming earlier. And I'll be back in the evening, because apparently tomorrow afternoon you're going off to Dhammasala, some of you. And I'll be back in the evening to finish off the retreat for those of you who are still here. And the following morning will be our Kirtana day. So it's a very busy life for a modern monk. But, like everybody, you just grab your moments when you can just be at still and be at peace. And those are very, very important in life. I teach some of the other people that, well, when I was over in Korea, teaching at the 2015 World Computer Conference, when people said, "What are you doing here?" giving the opening speech, and then I started telling them just how I remembered. First little story I told them was that I think St. Louis World's Fair, I think about 1920 something, that it just so happened, just by chance, that there was a gentleman who had the concession stall for selling waffles, just happened to be next to the gentleman who was selling ice cream. So two different food types, with no previous connection at all, waffles and ice cream. And those two people were talking together, being friends, and they came up with synergy to coil a waffle into a cone and put an ice cream on top, which is where we got the ice cream cone from. Just a chance encounter of totally different disciplines. And that's why I said, a Buddhist monk coming to a computer conference. This is a similar synergy. Two different places, different backgrounds, two different fields coming together. Who knows what might come next? So, first of all, it's wonderful that it doesn't matter what background you are from, sometimes coming to Jhana Grove, you may think this is just about meditation, but sometimes you go back and you get some ideas, some different ways of looking things, which can help in your meditation, in your company, or in your business, or in your work. There's so much that if we're just in a narrow field, that's all we see. And if we can just widen our perspectives, even doing things which seem to have no relation to our task at hand, we find that we can have innovation. So even as a monk, I need to innovate. Otherwise, we tend to get stale. So I'm very happy that when I come here and we have the questions, I do get more jokes material for my upcoming talks, innovation, new jokes. But in particular, I remember at that conference, not having any sort of PowerPoints, but just being able to just do whatever I had, and I lifted up a bottle of water. And that's actually when I asked people, how heavy is the bottle of water? Many of you have seen this before. How heavy is a bottle of water? The longer I hold it, the heavier it feels. I'm not talking about theory, I'm talking about experience. After 2 minutes, 3 minutes, 5 minutes, my arm starts to ache. It really feels heavy. And all I need to do is put it down, let it go, just relax. And I do that for 1 minute or more, and then when I pick it up, well, it feels much lighter, honestly. The weight of the water hasn't changed. What has changed is you've rested, which means afterwards you can actually pick it up and it's not such a burden for you. And of course, I hope that you've understood this is the meaning of stress and overcoming stress. Stress has got nothing to do with how many jobs, duties, responsibilities you have to hold. Stress has everything, it doesn't matter how big the water is, stress has everything to do with when it gets too heavy to bear, you just don't know how to put it down and rest. Just put it down and rest, relax, then a little while later, you're rested, when you pick it up, it's easy to actually to do. But more than that, it's not just about resting, because some people used to tell me that there's too many things to do. I can't afford to rest. There's deadlines to complete. Exactly. Which is where that one of these friends over in the United States, he told me that he meditates 1 hour every day. Except when he's busy. When he's busy, he meditates 2 hours a day. And I like that little saying because when you're really busy, why do you meditate more? And it was because he said, if he's really busy, he needs to be efficient. And that is what I've noticed, what many people notice. If you're tired, you're not efficient. You can watch your kids at night time. They've got an assignment to do. They're looking at the screen. They're not typing. If they do type anything, it's really bad quality. Or just like you in the afternoon and evening, you're really worn out. You're trying to just write a book or give a talk or answer an email. The words don't come out. You can't sort of construct anything because your brain is exhausted. So what you do in those times, if you really look like you're not being productive and efficient, you go and rest. And once you've rested for half an hour, quarter of an hour, then you go back to your work. Okay, half an hour not doing anything at all. But then the next 2 hours work, you get done in an hour. Fast, efficient, clear, good quality. And I taught that in so many places. That is actually taught in Harvard Business School as an investment of time. So if you're really busy, you haven't got much time to spare, you've got to use it wisely. So you relax, rest, take half an hour out, an hour, and you find afterwards you produce more. The half an hour, you're just sitting there meditating, relaxing, just making peace, being kind, being gentle. Afterwards, you make up with greater efficiency. More done, better quality, in less time. So that is actually how you learn from this retreat. It's not just getting enlightened. It's not just having a great time. It's also being a more efficient worker. Now, of course, some people say, well, in my office or home, it's so hard to find a place where you can just relax for a few minutes or half an hour. If they haven't got a meditation room like they've got in Google, Samsung, Facebook, if you haven't got a meditation room for people, there is at least what they call a restroom. Why do they call it restroom in the United States? Because it's to take a rest. So you tell your boss, I'm going to the restroom. What do you do there? Rest. So you can lock yourself in the toilet and just sit on it. Maybe take a cushion. And after half an hour, when you come out, he said, you were long in the toilet. Yeah, I was constipated. Don't accept that. And you're not lying, you're not breaking your precepts. You weren't like intestinally constipated. You were up here constipated. You were tired and weak. And that means you can have an opportunity to relax and let go and be free. That actually encourages you, you know, how to be more efficient in your life. So when people say, oh, you know, what can we do, you know, using these things out in the world, that's one way of doing it. But even deeper than that, I used this bottle of water in Daejeon in South Korea to a little exercise, because it's great not just talking to people, but getting you involved. So, please, tell me, what is this I'm holding up? What is it? Bottle of water, yeah, what else? Green cup, plastic, what else? Neighbor, what else? Keep looking. Yeah, what else? What else? What else? So, okay, I think I'm getting to the point now. When you first hold something up, you say it's a bottle of water. How many people look further? Bottle of water, got it, put it down, finished. And you think, is that right, is that wrong? And then you go ask people more, what is it, what is it, what is it? There's no right answer here. It's just the longer you look, the more you see. If you give it a label and think, oh, I know that now, you don't go any further. But if you hold it up, keep it there and keep looking, soon, hope soon, you'll get to a point where you've run out of labels. And then you can actually start to see this in a much better way. For example, it can be very good to, if somebody's snoring, it doesn't really hurt. There's all sorts of other uses to it. But our problem is because we don't stay long enough in an object, we don't manage to keep it in our mind long enough, we can't really penetrate it. All we see is old labels. Instead of seeing something we've never seen before. Keep it here, be still, and see if you can go deeper. That's called insight. To be able to keep it there long periods of time, and to understand what this insight is, and how it's nearly always associated with some happiness and joy. There is the simile, my old simile, of the path up from Southwest Highway up to Bodhinyana Monastery. 2.2 kilometers. And I'd been living in that monastery for about 7 or 8 years, you know, with our former monk Ajahn Chacko. And we were busy working, and if I was going anywhere, it would always be in a car, going down the hill to get some plumbing supplies or building supplies, going up afterwards, usually about 2 or 3 times a week. And one morning, we came back early enough, it was a beautiful morning like today, so instead of being in a car, I asked, I want to walk up this morning, plenty of time. And, of course, you have to argue with people. They say, no, 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 you mustn't walk. It's dangerous. No, 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 you mustn't walk. I'll give you a lift. No, 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 I need to make good karma. No, 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 if you get lost, they'll blame me, and I'll have to leave the country. No, no, no. So, I managed to argue and get out of the car. And once I'd got out of the car and started walking up, the car went up, back to the monastery. And just, you know, hours walk up there, just very slow. It's only about 2 kilometers, but just take it easy. In no rush. And as I was walking up that hillside, it was a very strange, unexpected experience. Because I could not recognize my surroundings at all. Everything looked totally different than I'd expected, than I remembered. And that was really stunning, because I'd been living at Bodhinyana Monastery for about 7 years at the time, up and down so many times, You know, you thought you knew where you were, but it looked totally different. And that was so weird, I stopped and stared. And that's when it changed again. When I stood perfectly still, I began to see things that I'd never expected to see before. There was a little brook in the bottom of the valley, which you could see clearly now, and the little rocks and tiny waterfalls. You saw all the lichen on the tree bark and on the stones. You saw so much there, and even the grass and the little flowers poking up through the grass. I'd never seen them before. But now I could. And they were just so beautiful in the morning sunshine. And I was stunned. How come I'd never noticed that before? And that was when I started to contemplate. Get the data first, explore, and then join the dots to find out what it means. And after a few minutes, I realized what was happening was a great simile for insight, but based on just normal, understandable biology and chemistry. When you see something with your eyes, it's a chemical reaction which happens on the back of your eye, the retina. That takes time for the reaction to complete, for the colors to form, the details to emerge. And the closest I could say to that was, I remember in school many, many years ago, people my age may have done this, that we used to develop our own photographs. And you'd have the photographic paper, you'd expose it to the image, you put it in a chemical solution, and very, very slowly the colors would emerge. And the shapes would emerge. You take it out too quickly, and it's not properly developed. It takes a time, a few minutes, for the image to emerge from the photographic paper. Of course, these days it's just an eye camera, just almost immediate. But that's pretty similar to what happens in the back of your eye. It takes a time. And what I was doing, looking through the window of a speeding car, those images were flashing at my eye so fast that no image was properly formed. Going so fast, and then another one, so I didn't see much detail, and the colors hadn't fully developed. It was like pastel, washed out, smudged, without much detail, because my eye didn't have time. Then, when I got out of the car and started walking, I had more time. The image on the back of my eye formed more completely. I started to see more detail, which I hadn't expected to see before. And it was more beautiful. And when I stood perfectly still, that was when you saw everything. The image had a full time, all the time it needed to fully form in your retina, and the image to be transmitted to your brain, and your brain to be able to explore it. And that was when the colors looked so gorgeous and beautiful. Only when I was still that I could see and appreciate that hillside as if for the first time. I never realized what was there when you look through the window of a speeding car. Now I think you get the message there. Most of us live our life as if in a fast car in our body. So many deadlines to meet, so many things to do. Whoosh, 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 whoosh. And because of that, even the road, the street where we live, I don't know how many times you've ever walked down that street, but if you've always been in a car and you try walking in down the street, it looks totally different than you'd expected before. You see so many different things. Because through the window of a car, you're going fast. When you walk, you're going slowly. But if you sit perfectly still or stand perfectly still, that's the best of all. Then you can really see things. Which is a wonderful simile for insight. But it's not just insight, it's just enjoyment as well. When the mind is still, everything tends to look incredibly beautiful. Even, again, similarly, a Bodhinyana monastery. Ah, oh, sometimes I get too busy. I have many, many jobs. Multitasking, that is my middle name, Ajahn Multitask Brahm. But what happens is, now you're looking after Bodhinyana, are you looking after this retreat? At the same time, you're just looking after the monks over in Bodhinyana Monastery, and then you go to Dhammaloka tonight, and you go looking after, actually she's gone now, the Anukampa Bhikkhuni Project, and so many little, and you know that one day I started to get so tired, and somebody was in Bodhinyana Monastery, and they come up to me and said, oh, you're so lucky. That monastery is so peaceful and so beautiful. You're so lucky to live in a wonderful place like that. And I said, you must be joking. What do you mean, peaceful? Is this monk going crazy? This monk arguing? This thing to be done? You've got to put up a siren. You look at the gate and there's a gate crasher. There's so many things to do over there. And I've just come back from Nolama with so many other things to do. And I couldn't appreciate the peace and the beauty in the monastery where I lived. And every now and again, someone shows some photographs of that place. So, oh, this is a beautiful place. Where is this? It was where I lived. I could see it. Now, a photograph is actually still. That's why you can actually see lots of beauty in it. Much more so than the video. So I was actually quite shocked on that. And I thought, something is very, very wrong here. How come you could see the peace and the beauty and the tranquility and I couldn't? And I realized it was because I was the boss. I was the abbot. I was the head honcho, as they say in in Australia. The CEM. Chief Executive Monk. So because of that, I realized because you had ownership, you had lots of busyness. So I started this little change of perception, not to be the abbot on a Monday morning, but to be a visitor. I'd pretend, I'd role play, I'd imagine, I am just like you, coming over from some place, another country, and just visiting for the morning. So when somebody would ask me, oh, Ajahn Brahm, you know, can you ask my questions on meditation? So, sorry, I'm only visiting. And they say, Ajahn Brahm, look, one of the monks has had a heart attack. So, well, it's not my problem. I'm only visiting. There's a telephone call from you, from Mr. Trump. I'm only visiting. And you know, once I pretended to be the visitor to that place, and you really got to get into it, just pretend you're a visitor, then you've got nothing to do. And then I could really start to relax and enjoy the place. Just the same, you're a visitor to Jhana Grove. That's why you can really enjoy it. Yeah, you're not going to trash your rooms, but you know, you don't worry too much about it, you're going to be leaving soon. And just, you know, you do little jobs and duties, but you don't have that lingering responsibility called ownership. You're visiting. You're not an owner. And that was the key thing. Being an owner rather than a visitor. If I own the place, then I've got to look after it. And I've got to tell people off as well, you know, when they do things wrong. That's all part of being an owner. But if you're a visitor, when you go to somebody's house, or even more than that, when you go to a restaurant for dinner, do you wash up afterwards? Do you go into the kitchen? Maybe if you don't pay. But do you go... Do you go off in there and just wash up? Because that's not your job. You're a visitor. Or, you know, if you go to somebody's house and they invite you for dinner, you know, do you sort of, you know, wash up afterwards? Of course you don't. You go to somebody's house, just, you know, just for the afternoon for a cup of tea. You know, do you vacuum the carpet afterwards and go out and mow their lawn and do all those other jobs and take the trash out? And you're a visitor, you're a guest. You don't do that sort of stuff because you don't own it. You can enjoy it without this terrible burden of ownership. And when I started to really get into this idea, this insight, of just, why is it so busy? Why can't I enjoy the place like other people? Why can't I just be a visitor? And that was one of the wonderful ways of interpreting anatta, non-self. Not me, not mine. Not a permanent essence. So when I meditate, I'm only visiting my mind. I don't own it. So I'm not going to wash up my mind afterwards. I'm not going to vacuum and clean up all the mess in my mind. I'm just visiting. It's not my problem, Nanya. None of my business. But if you own your meditation, if it's so important, you've got to develop it, like you've got to keep your house clean, develop it. If you own it, then you control it, and you can't enjoy its beauty. You always want to develop it and get to the next stage. But if you're only visiting your mind, you have no ownership, no responsibilities. It's amazed how peaceful and how beautiful your mind can be. You can appreciate it, rather than always trying to get rid of the faults and develop it. You don't vacuum the carpet on somebody's house you're visiting, so you don't even get rid of the defilements in the mind you're visiting. When you don't try and get rid of them, they don't become defilements anymore. No wanting, no aversion, no delusion. None of my business. Oh, what peace to visit your mind when you don't own it, when it doesn't belong to you. Oh, your body. You're only visiting your body for 60, 70, 80 years. It's not yours. Yeah, you kind of look after it. But there are times, okay, body, I've looked after you. Now I'm going to leave you alone. Look after yourself. Sometimes it's great being able to do that. Just let the body go. Why? Because you don't own it. If you think you own it, you'd always be worried about it. If you think you're just visiting, then you can let it go. So these are little ways, little insights, which actually help. Help you to actually have a nice peaceful mind. When you say just visiting this body or this mind, this is actually goes back to, how can I just be here with this stupid old mind? Because it's wonderful to be stupid. There's lots of advantages of being stupid. Just like one of my favorite monks. This monk is a Thai monk. I heard of him when I first ordained. He was fully enlightened, a great monk. But he started his life off at grade one school in one of the very rural schools in the middle of the northeast of Thailand. And after 1 year in grade one in a village school, the teacher had to fail him. He didn't pass grade one. And I'd never found out, how on earth can you fail grade one? Is it plasticine or stick drawings you can't do properly? I mean, that's what I remember from grade one. I mean, how can you fail that? But he did. So he had to be kept back to repeat grade one a second year. Well, all his friends advanced. Second year, failed again. So the teacher gave him one last chance. Third year, just doing grade one, and he failed a third time. They just could not sort of advance him to grade two. Now that is like Guinness Book of Records style dumbness. But, what happened to that kid? What can you do in a village with someone who is so, so dumb? It reminds me of this Vietnamese comic, is An Do. Because you know, just keep in contact with just the Vietnamese community as well. And, you know, I said, why is he a comic? And he has some really, really great jokes. And he said once that a little Vietnamese boy comes back from school and said, Daddy, Daddy, what does IQ mean? And Daddy says, well, IQ is like a measure of intelligence. Now, most people are average, 100 is average intelligence. If you've got 120, you're really smart. 140, you probably go to university. Now, 80, you know, you can be a bricklayer or something. If you only got 60 or 50 IQ, you know, you're probably so stupid you can't even tie up your own shoelaces. A little boy said, oh, is that why most Australians have to wear thongs? Okay, that's not true. I'm an Australian citizen these days. But, yeah, that's the IQ. But this fellow just really was right down there. So what do you do with someone like that? There's only in Thailand, there's only one place you can send such a young man who can't pass grade one. The monastery. They ordained him as a novice monk in the monastery. And because, you know, some of these monks in the old days, you know, their Vinaya may have not been so strict. They would, you know, have money and maybe even a TV there, but they were really kind. And sometimes I look at those and just, they wouldn't amass wealth, they just give it all away. Live very, very simply. And just their compassion was just quite impressive. And this was one of those monks who just look after this little boy. You know, spend so many hours trying to teach it just simple Buddhist chanting like Namo Tassa. You get to Namo and then get onto the second word, Tassa, and he said, what was the first word again? He was just really had learning difficulties. And after 2 or 3 years, even the abbot of this village monastery was just so frustrated, couldn't do anything with him. He sent him to the only place left, the forest monasteries, where I trained. Not all people who go to forest monasteries are so dumb. This is not my biography. What happened to this fellow was amazing, because he wasn't trying to learn any chanting, wasn't trying to just, you know, learn the stuff you learn in school. Just the teacher just told him, just make peace, be kind, be gentle, just watch your breath. And that was the simplest thing in the world for him to do. He had such a clear, open mind, unencumbered by thoughts and ideas and learning, that he got into deep meditation almost straight away. And he became one of the great enlightened beings in Thailand. And he said that when he couldn't chant, you know, he couldn't learn any chanting. What he did do is like a little trick, like a loophole. When there was any chanting to do, he'd remember a previous life when he did have a brain, and he'd contact that previous life where he did learn the chanting and transfer it to this life, where he could do chant. So he only managed to do chanting by contacting his previous life and linking with it, and that's how he did the chanting. It's interesting, isn't it? And so sometimes, all those years at high school and university, oh, you'd have had much better meditation, much faster if I'd have avoided that. But no, you can use everything. What he was actually saying was just the simplicity and the peace of the mind. Everybody has got their place in this world, just like the trees in the forest. No one is excluded. It's just finding just that right place, that right time for that right person, and then it's amazing what you can do. So if there is anybody who is, you know, just hasn't got that visual mind or that thinking mind, that logical mind, it's so much easier to meditate. You just sit there, just watch your breath. And so I think, how do I watch the breath? Should I watch the breath this way or that way? Or should I just watch at the tip of the nose on my belly? Is it a long one or a short one? Ajahn Brahm said don't even point to the breath or really worry about where you're watching it. But the other teachers say you should do it this way. And then maybe if I did it that way, it might be better. And the suttas say this way. And actually not just the suttas, but also the agamas say something else. And by the time you decided what you do, the meditation period is over and you've got nowhere because you've been thinking too much, trying to decide what to do. So that's, you know, I think you can relate to that. At least someone can relate to that. So, keeping it peaceful and simple is wonderful. So that's the way you do it. Just, I'm not an owner. I'm just a visitor. And the other one is just sort of similar to that. Beautiful little ways of meditating. I'm not telling you, watch the breath, do it this way, stage one, stage two, stage three, stage four. Just where all those stages come from, just how it works. And that was that story. I passed it in brief about the difference between being in prison and being free. And of course, you know, this is when, quite honestly, because I've been in some of these prisons, not in Changi, because Changi is quite harsh. At least, I think, was it Section A or B or something, the really tough part of the prison. But, you know, in some of the prisons in Australia, even the tough ones, they are actually just amazingly sort of soft. Really good food, three or four meals a day, whatever you want. If you want to be vegetarian, you can be vegetarian, you can do whatever. And they have TVs, and they have, what else there? Sports, you can play soccer, you can play tennis, nice beds. It's actually quite, and schools, you don't want to do a degree, it's actually quite pleasant. Sometimes you wonder why anybody would want to escape from prisons in Australia. But they do, you know. And sometimes people tell me, amazing, these people are wasted in prison. There's this one guy. You know, he had a remote. He had a remote for the TV, you know, which had a TV in the sort of the room. They could. He had a remote. He rewired it so he could open all the locks. Click, click, click. He was a genius. And another guy, he was his case officer over in Perth, in the Department of Corrections, in head office. You know, he had to sort of talk with the case officer every now and again, and he listened so mindfully until he could imitate his big case officer's voice. And when he had his monthly free phone call, he didn't ring up his family, he rang up the superintendent's office in that prison where he was, and he imitated this big case officer in the head office voice and said, you know, superintendent, we're in a big trouble here, you know, that we just found out that prisoner has been wrongly convicted and put in jail, and look, we're going to be sued, it's really dangerous, so we have to release him right away, otherwise we'll be in big trouble. And the superintendent brought it. They went to his cell almost immediately, better pack your things, you know, you've been released. And he was out. Oh, while we were on that, there was over in England, people told me the story. They have all these different securities. The security which looks after you while you're in prison, the security when you're being transported to court, and the security which is actually inside the court, and you've got to hand over to one another. So this old prisoner in UK, he was going for his appeal. So, in the prison, they transported him, you know, just into this car, I think it was Group 4 security or something, and they took him over to the court, and in the court they handed him over to the court security, and after his trial for appeal, the court security handed over to the Group 4 to be transported back to prison. But the people in the Group 4 security said, oh, how did it go? They said, amazing! Now the judge saw my side of the story. I've been acquitted. And the group force said, really? Well, what do we do next? And he said, well, if you wouldn't mind, would you like to give me a lift to the train station? Yeah, sure. So they took him to the train station and they, you know, shook hands and said, have a wonderful life on the outside. You know, just don't do anything bad again. We don't want to see you again. We wish you all good fortune and good luck on the outside. And having waved him off, shook hands, then they went back to the depot. And that was when they found, where have you been? Where's the prisoner? He'd been acquitted. No, he wasn't. He talked his way out of the prison. And those two groups of security guards, I think they got sent to prison. I'm not sure, but they certainly got sacked. But anyway, being in prison. Who wants to get out of prison? Yeah, there was this entire story. And this is actually how you use your wisdom for wonderful means. The monk's name was Chalkuntep Sitimuni. He was the abbot of, I remember it in a moment, but it's just opposite, just Wat Mahathat, which is, you know, next to the central field on the banks of the Mekong River, central Bangkok. So he was a very good monk, very senior, and he was the next in line to become the head monk in Thailand, the Sangharaja of Thailand. Very good monk. But the number three in line was jealous. Number three wanted to be the top, but number two was in his way. So what can I do? So this number three monk, he started recording, you know, some of the talks which this number two monk gave. And you cut out a bit here, splice it there, put it all together, and it appeared that he was promoting communism. And that time, big communist scare all over Southeast Asia. And so he was accused of being a communist. And at his trial, you know, he didn't defend himself. Oh yeah, whatever happens, just like that story I said about that that's actually in the monastery. Whatever happens, if it happens, fine, doesn't really matter, let it go. Not me, not mine, not a self. So he was convicted and put in jail. And when he was put in jail, he was in jail for about a couple of years. And after a year or two, or just a year maybe, the head monk passed away. So number three monk got his wish and became the head monk of Thailand. And then what happened? They were going from central Bangkok to the old airport in Don Mueang, to the north of Bangkok, in a motorcade with security. There you had the driver, and the head monk was behind in the back seat, cars in front, and on the opposite side of the road, a car was coming and lost control and slammed into the middle car of the motorcade where the Sangharaja was sitting. He was killed instantly. No one else was injured. Now, in the Buddhist Thai tradition, if that is weird, why no one else injured but just this person, this head monk? And they say that must be karma. Something weird had happened. And they checked through, well, what did this monk do? And that's when they looked through the transcripts of that trial and they realized that the reason was that he very falsely accused this very good monk of being a communist to get him out of the way so he could succeed. And as soon as that was, they heard he wasn't a communist at all, he was just a good monk, that was when they released him. And he said, oh, I'm having a good time in here. He said, I can catch up on my reading, I can rest as much as I like, and I can do my meditation. It's like being on retreat for 2 or 3 years. And he wrote this wonderful book, you know, in Thai, but I saw a nice translation of it, about what a wonderful thing that was, to be 2 years or 3 years in a jail, meditating peaceful, because it was better than being in this monastery. And I remember, that was a really good monk. You know, Yeah, he said, I don't want to be Sangharaja. I just, do whatever I can, but I just like being a peaceful monk. So, what it means is that sometimes, what is a prison anyway? For that monk, it's a retreat. What is the difference between a prison and freedom? And the only difference is, being free means you want to be here. Being in a prison means you want to be somewhere else. Doesn't matter how comfortable it is. If you want to be somewhere else, it's a prison for you. Even jhana growth. If you're fed up, if you want to go home, jhana growth is now your prison. If you have a relationship, and it feels like a prison for you, when you go home to your wife, your husband, whatever. If it's, it's like a prison. If you're in a job you really hate, you don't like going there in the morning, then your job, your office is like a prison. If you're an old body which is sick and ailing, falling apart, your body can feel like a prison if you want to be somewhere else. And even if you are meditating, you are here just watching your breath. Yeah, I've done that before. I want to go deeper. Then that breath becomes your prison. You don't want to be here. You're suffering. And it's so easy to escape from the prisons of your life. You don't need to change your partner. Change your attitude. Want to be here rather than wanting to be somewhere else. Your job. Want to be there rather than want to be somewhere else. If you enjoy your job, don't tell your boss. If you do, he will cut down your salary. Remember what a salary really is? It's a bribe to make you do something you'd rather not do. And if you're in an old body which is sick and falling apart, you've got aches and pains, your heart, you've got the flu, whatever it is, do you want to be here? Or do you want to be somewhere else? If you want to be here with your sneezy old body, then you're free. Happy to be here. And it's amazing where you can find freedom, anywhere. Doesn't matter whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable, it's whether you want to be here or not. And that's really important with your meditation. Wherever you are, whatever's happening to you, you've got sloth and torpor, you're restless, you've got sexy thoughts, you've got nimittas, and the mind is blissing out. Do you want to be here or not? If you don't want to be here, you're tight, tense. You've got a problem. You're in prison. If you want to be here, you're free. That's the difference between being in prison and freedom. Nothing to do with the situation, where you are, painful, whatever it is. Very much to do with your attitude, happy to be here, or want to be somewhere else. So, understanding those insights, that's why it actually helps in the meditation. This is insight meditation. The insights, the wisdom which helps you go deeper into your meditation. Already when you get the question time, the interview time, so many people say, I've got so far but I can't go further. So obvious what the problem is and what the solution is. You're getting so far but you can't go further because you want to go further. You're not happy being where you are. It could even be like a nimitta, these beautiful lights in the mind, but I want to get jhana. The nimitta becomes your prison. That's why you can't go further. I don't want it, I want to go further. I don't like being here, I want to develop more. So this is actually where we understand some of the big blockages in meditation, simply because we make prisons out of states of mind. So, wherever you are, want to be here. Don't complain. No one's listening. So I'm here sitting down. Do you want to be here? Do you want to be somewhere else? So I want to be here. I want to be here. I want to be here. Then you find freedom and peace. Doesn't matter what you're experiencing. So that is part of the insight. But then sometimes, well, what about the, you know, that, okay, that's good for life. That is good for, you know, being able to you know, survive husbands and wives and kids and heat and cold and bosses from hell, all that sort of stuff. But, you know, how does that actually relate to getting into deep meditation, even enlightenment, finding out the truth of things? How does that insight happen? And that's actually where full moon night still, if you do want to understand what I mean, you can go down and see the lake at night time. Oh, I'd be happy to be there. When? Oh, actually, I haven't told you the coffin story yet, have I? Oh, no. No. You reminded me of that one. Okay, I'll finish off with that one. But first of all, if you really want, if you really want to know the how insight works, you just go down to the lake, you know, when it's dark or early in the morning, and if you can sit down there, and if there's no wind, what does that lake look like? If it's perfectly still, with no ripples or waves on the surface, then you get this incredible reflection of the full moon and maybe the stars, some of the stars anyway. But if there's any ripple or disturbance on that surface of the lake, the image is distorted. You can't really see what's there. And the lake stands for your mind. Only when your mind is perfectly still do you get a true reflection of the Dhamma. Dhamma's always there, but our mind is just too agitated, too many waves on the surface. We don't get a good reflection. But only when the lake is still do you see things as they truly are. Just like, okay, how many people haven't heard the coffin story? How many people have heard it? The minority, yes! I've got a good reason to tell the coffin story. And those of you who have heard it, you know what's going to happen, so it's good fun. So, this gentleman went to the temple to listen to a Dhamma talk one night, and when it finished, it was late, and it was dark, and he had two choices. He could either go the long way round, or take the shortcut across the cemetery. Do you believe in ghosts? This guy didn't. He's a modern person. No, not gullible. Scientist. No such thing as ghosts. So he decided to take the shortcut across the cemetery. Halfway across the cemetery, nothing happened. Quiet, no problems at all. But even though he didn't believe in ghosts, amazing just how many people just, oh, maybe, who knows. So he was a little bit on edge. And just out past the halfway point, that's when he thought he heard something behind him. You know, actually sometimes you can feel that someone is following you or looking at you. That's what he actually felt. Both artists, imagination, he carried on walking. But his ears, you know, really were mindful, listening if anything was coming behind him. And it almost like something was following him, doing a bump, bump, bump behind him. I'm just imagining, just fear. And just maybe about 5 meters from the end of the cemetery, he could actually hear it. There was something following him, it was clear. Bump, bump, bump. And so he started running. Whatever it was following him, that also increased its speed. Bump, bump, bump. And then he made a big mistake. he looked around. And his heart almost stopped. His body froze. Because what he saw clearly was a coffin. A coffin standing vertical with the dirt and the mud falling off and cobwebs all over it. He was being chased by a coffin. He ran as fast as he could. But didn't matter how fast he ran, bump, 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 the coffin was catching up on him. Fortunately, his house was really close by. He had one of these little gates, like garden gates. He didn't open the gate. He jumped right over it. Bump, 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 coming closer and closer. And as he got to the front door of the house, the coffin was at the gate. Bump! As it tried to bash through the gate, he got out his keys. You know what happens. Every time, you know, you're anxious, you get out the keys and you drop them. Bump! As it crashed through the front gate. This was touch and go. He picked up the first key, put it in the lock. Oh, so lucky it was the right key. Turned the lock, opened the door, ran inside. Just felt the front door of the house, just as the coffin came to the front door. You could see it through, you know, the glass pane in the front door. You could see the coffin there. He was sweating, his heart was palpitating, but he made it. He was safe inside the house. Bump! As the coffin hit the front door. Bump! As the hinges started to give way. He ran up the stairs. There was only one room, and one other room which had a lock. That was the bathroom. And he got to the top of the stairs and turned around. Bump! As the coffin broke through the front door. And there he stared, the coffin, the bottom of the stairs, him at the top of the stairs. I know, maybe coffins can't climb stairs. No. Bump, 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 bump. As the coffin started to climb the stairs. So he ran into the bathroom, locked the door. But the coffin had seen him. The coffin came round outside the bathroom door. Bump! He was in big trouble now, because if a front door with security locks and everything, if a coffin can break through that, the bathroom door, no hope. Bump! As the door started to splinter, bump! And the coffin was through. No more place to hide. As you do, you spread eagle against the wall, the back wall, as the coffin came for him. Instinctively, not knowing what he was doing, he picked up anything from the shelf and threw it at the coffin. It was a bottle of medicine. It broke. And the coffin stopped. It froze, never moved again. Never moved again, that coffin. It was cough mixture. It stops the coffin. Even if you've heard it before, it's still funny. Okay. 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 Oh, for the interviews this morning, when you do the interviews, please just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, because I did actually change the order, because there was somebody put at top, one at the bottom. Instead of actually waiting in between, I just listed them. So now the order is 9 o'clock Tony, 9:10 Ren, 9:20 Vera G, 9:30 Yen Lin, 9:40 Yu Qian, 9:50 Tan, and 10 o'clock Mariani. So I check it, make sure that you've got the right time. Okay, very good. Carry on. Bump. Bump.